off. We have Acts chapter 12 is well, let me kind of give you a map here. And basically, you know, the church here originated, started here in Jerusalem. You know, it's hard to know the date Christ died. I subscribe to a 33 AD date. Some folks end up at 32 or 31. I mean, it's, you know, but it's somewhere around there. It's about, it's so he died there. And when we get to the end of chapter 12, it's about 44 AD. So about 11 years that have gone by, maybe 12, but about 11 years that have gone by. And the reason we know that is that at the end of chapter 12 that we're going to read this morning, we have the death of Herod Agrippa. And that's a well-known historical fact that's attested by Josephus and a bunch of other people. So we know we have that. So the church goes here. And in the book of Acts, we've sort of seen Acts chapter 1 as being fulfilled slowly. The gospel goes out, remember, to Samaria, then the Gaza Road, and then to Lydda and Joppa, and then to Caesarea, going to the Samaritans, and finally going to the Gentiles up here in Caesarea. And then there's the persecution. Obviously, we have the gospel going to Damascus over here, where Paul gets converted. And then the church really sets up home here in Antioch. It's actually a little closer to, it's only 14 miles, it's a little bit closer, was the third largest city in the Roman Empire. And it becomes clearly the focus moves away, because the Jerusalem church is still primarily made up of Jews who've trusted Christ. The Antioch church is a real blend of Gentiles and Jews, with probably more Gentiles than Jews in the church. In fact, certainly more. So we've been reading in Acts chapter 10 and 11 about what's happening up here in Antioch. Clearly the church is forming. Barnabas has gone up there. The Apostle Paul's, well, Saul, soon to be the Apostle Paul, is up there. And the church is functioning over here. Paul was at a place called Tarsus for, I don't know, maybe 8, 9, 10 years. It's hard to know how long, but a long period of time. Actually, probably about 8 years. He was up there. Barnabas goes and fetches him, and they come back down here, and they're a year teaching in the church in Antioch. And the church in Antioch starts to become kind of the center. And starting in Acts chapter 13, the gospel is going to go out from Antioch to Cyprus and all the way eventually to Rome. But Acts chapter 12 is a sort of a meanwhile back at the ranch kind of a chapter. We've been talking about the Gentiles coming to Christ, the church being founded, Gentiles in Acts chapter 10, the church in Antioch. And this is sort of a last meanwhile back at the ranch, what's happening in Jerusalem, where Peter and the church are still functioning. So that's sort of where we are, kind of a flashback. And if you remember, the end of chapter 11, it says a prophet had come and said there was going to be a famine in this area. And so the church in Antioch sent some gifts, probably finances of some sort, to the church in Jerusalem here. And Barnabas and Saul were the ones who took it down there. So at the end of chapter 11, we have the church in Antioch is growing. Barnabas and Paul, Saul, are teaching there for a year. They hear news that the church in Jerusalem is struggling financially. They take up an offering, and they send Paul and Barnabas down to give the money. And that's when we get to chapter 12. So pick up your notes here, and we will read chapter 12. It's a long chapter, but it's a pretty cool chapter. So we're going to read it through here. About that time, King Herod Agrippa began to persecute some believers in the church. He had the apostle James, John's brother, killed with a sword. And we talked about that a little bit last week. You know, the inner three were Peter, James, and John. And I mean, this is just a sad verse. I mean, here's somebody Jesus discipled specially for 3 years, and in one verse, he's just killed. Boom. And yet God's program doesn't fall apart. You know, one of two things, and that's a good question, that he was either beheaded like John the Baptist, or they would just took the sword and ran it through him. And no one knows for sure. Those are two ways that they killed him. Either chopped their head off with a sword or just ran them through with a sword. a nice Roman way of operating. Short and sweet. Here the Apostle James killed with a sword, and we talked about the enigma of that last week. When Herod saw how much this pleased the Jewish people, he also arrested Peter. Now that's an important verse there, because this is the first verse where Jewish people are used in a clearly negative sense. The church and the Jewish community are clearly now moving apart. You know, up until now, the Christians in Jerusalem, who were originally Jews, had probably seen themselves as some sort of fulfillment of the Old Testament. I don't think they'd really seen themselves as a completely separate new group. They were still going to the temple, and there was this transition going on. Now, obviously, there was persecution in Acts chapter 8, but that sort of was sort of earmarked as Paul. But here you clearly see now the Jewish people and the leaders in Jerusalem are clearly being differentiated from the church and the growing body of Christ here. So that's quite an important thing. In fact, they're so antagonistic that they are happy to have Herod kill one of the leaders of this new group. So there's more than just, we don't like you. I mean, this is a fierce antagonism. And they're obviously fighting, you know, fighting for their place in the sun. And they're being squeezed out, you know, by the new group, perhaps. Okay, when Herod saw how much this pleased the Jewish people, he also arrested Peter. This took place during the Passover celebration. So clearly the Jewish people are egging on Herod. And if you read about Herod Agrippa, as opposed to Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa tried to cultivate the favor of the Jewish people. If you read Josephus and some of the historians there, he gave gifts and money to the Jews, and there was a real relationship where he did whatever the Jews wanted him to do, and they kept him secure as a king. It was a kind of a relationship. This took place during Passover celebration. When was Jesus killed? Passover celebration. So a little bit of irony here. This is happening during Passover celebration here. Then, yeah, there were two. There's Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa, three, and Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the one who was around at Jesus' time. He's the one who killed the babies. And then Herod Antipas was more in the Galilee area. And then Herod Agrippa, this Herod, took over really from Herod the Great. And he had more power. He had power in Jerusalem. Pardon? This would be Herod Agrippa here gets killed in 44. So probably, you know, 35 to 44, somewhere around there.
Which one of them built Masada?
You know, I don't know. And it could have been Herod the Great, because he was the one that was there for a long time. Remember, he was the one who killed the babies when Jesus was young. So it could have been him. I don't know that. Okay. He imprisoned them, placing them under guard of four squads of four soldiers each. Now we sort of pass over that. That's 16 people guarding one guy. And the tradition, although it doesn't say it here, is that he would have been tied to two of the guards, and the other 14 would have been in and around. So, you know, this is serious imprisonment. Herod intended to bring Peter out for public trial after Passover, and no doubt to run him through with a sword, just like he did with James. But while Peter was in prison, the church prayed very earnestly for him. Verse 5 is always an enigma. What did they pray for? As you get down, it's unlikely they were praying for him to be released because they didn't expect that to happen. And James had already been killed, so they were probably praying, you know, give him strength, give him courage, help him to share his faith in prison, you know, just make it, you know, something that's not as painful, help him to stand firm in the faith, things of that nature. It's possible they were praying for his release. There might have been a few faithful people there. There might have been the Larry Love and a few people like that who really pray out there, really trusting God, but most of them, I don't think, were doing that. All right, then the story. The night before Peter was to be placed on trial, he was asleep. Fastened with two chains between two soldiers. So it actually does say it. I forgot about that. Others stood guard at the prison gate. So the 16 guys guarding him. Suddenly, there was a bright light in the cell, and an angel of the Lord stood beside Peter. Just as, you know, in the book of Acts, angels appear a number of times, right? When's the last time we saw an angel? Angel talked to Philip, remember, and said, go to the Gaza Road. Angels were active in the life of Jesus, and angels were active in the life of the early church. And who knows, maybe they're active today, we just don't see them. But those of us who have children believe that someone looked after our kids when they were going through a difficult thing. We had this house in Texas that had, was like an acre and a half, and behind that trees and a kind of like a kind of a little bit of a swale. And then about two houses down, a house down, there was a road, and there's a culvert that went under the road. And when Michael was probably about, I don't know, probably six, seven or eight, we had one of those Texas rain. When you get Texas rain, there's a gully washing and just it's a huge storm. Anyway, they were playing and swimming, and he got caught up in it, and he got caught up, and they flushed him through the culvert under the road and popped up on the other side. And as there'd been a tree or anything, and the culvert was probably only this big. So there are angels. There are angels out there that look after our... comes in the house there, a little white and wide-eyed. Yeah, I just got sucked through the road. What do you mean? So God is operating today, and we probably just don't see him. Others stood guard the prison gate. Suddenly, the bright light. The angels struck him on the side to waken him. That's also interesting. He's going to be put on trial the next day for his life. And what's he doing? Sleeping. Heck, I just have a deal go bad and I stay awake all night. He's going to be killed the next day, or at least he's going to be put on trial. And obviously, Herod's batting average at that stage was 1-for-1. So, I mean, the chances of Peter being killed was very, very high if you played the law of averages. And yet he was sleeping. And, you know, that does tell us something. You know, God is in control. That does not mean he doesn't allow odd things to happen. I mean, if I was Peter's family, I'd be ecstatic that he's released. If I was James's family, I'd be disappointed that God hadn't done the same miracle for him that he did for Peter. So God's in control. Every now and again, he does miracles, but not usually. But every now and again, he does them just to remind us he really is in control of the situation. Anyway, angel struck someone and said, wait, quick, get up. And the chains fell off his wrists. Now, what would you have done if that happened? I would have broken the 100-yard dash record. Get out of here. But it's interesting, when God is working, he works at his own pace and his own way. Angel said, get dressed. What do you mean, get dressed? Get dressed and put on your sandals. I don't need sandals to run out of this place. But it's sort of like when God is working, he kind of works at his pace and does his sort of thing. So get dressed, put on your sandals. Now put on your coat and follow me, the angel ordered. And Peter did these things. Again, sometimes when I think God is working, I want to help him and move a little bit ahead of him. The hardest thing in following God is not to get ahead of him and not to get behind him. Just to stay on an even pace. And we're so obtuse at times that when we see God do a little bit of work, we want to run ahead of him. And then, of course, other times we're behind him. But we don't want to get ahead of him. Verse 9. So Peter left the cell following the angel. But all the time he thought it was a vision or a dream. He didn't realize it was actually happening. They passed the first and second guard posts and came to the iron gate leading to the city. So you not only have 16 guys guarding them, there seem to be at least three doors you have to go through. And the final door opened for them all by itself. So they passed through and started walking down the street. Then suddenly the angel left them. Angels tend to do that. Same happened with Philip. Remember, the angel took him to the Gaza Strip and left him. Angels just form a function, and then he's on his own. Peter finally comes to his senses. Wow, it's really true, he said. The Lord has sent his angel and saved me from Herod and from what the Jewish leaders has planned to do to me. Again, the distancing between the Jewish leaders and the church. Verse 12, when he realized this, he went to the home of Mary, the mother of John Mark. It's the first mention of John Mark, who obviously is going to become important to the story because he's going to go with Paul and Barnabas on the first missionary journey there. Mary was probably a widow because her husband is never mentioned, and most of the commentators say that had there been a husband, generally he would have been referred to in some way. So she was obviously a widow. She was obviously fairly wealthy because she had this big house. The home of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many were gathered for prayer. So it's a big enough house that many were gathered for prayer. It's also a big enough house that we're going to see in a moment she had a maid or a maid servant, and there seemed to be maybe even a courtyard kind of a place there, which is actually quite interesting because in Acts chapter 2 and chapter 4, when Barnabas and the folks sold their property and gave it to the church, it was clear not everyone sold their property. It was voluntary as the Spirit guided them and directed them. Some of them held onto their homes and didn't sell them. So it wasn't a mandatory thing. It was a voluntary thing of people who did that, because here's Mary having a home. So he went to the home of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many were gathered for prayer. They're praying in the house. He knocked at the door in the gate, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to open it. Again, you know, you clearly have a little bit of an upper class, at least middle to upper class there. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed that instead of opening the door, she ran back inside and told everyone, Peter is standing at the door. And for those who are historians, you know, because people who attack the Bible just say, this is just made up. Someone just made up a miracle to make Peter look great. But people who comment on whether things are historical or made up often look at little facts like that really, you would only add them if they really happened. they think he's knocking at the door and then he's still knocking at the door. The details here are things that tend to show even to non-Christians that this is an event that really happened. He's standing at the door. You're out of your mind, they said. And the reason I'm sympathetic with that is that would probably be my great faith. Lord, deliver Peter. He arrives at the door. Oh, no. So I'm afraid that I have very little faith. When God does answer my prayers, I'm sort of blown over, whereas I should have more of the faith to expect him to answer my prayers. But I'm a little bit like these guys, yeah. When she insisted, they decided it must be his angel. First of all, you're mistaken. Second, it must be his angel. And that reflected a Jewish belief that's hard to support from the Old Testament, but a Jewish belief that when people died, the angels sort of represented them down here on earth. And so that's what they're saying. Maybe it's his angel saying he's probably been killed already and his angel has come. Now, they did have enough faith to believe the angels could show up at the door. So there's some sense that God is working in their midst. Meanwhile, Peter continued knocking. I love that. That's a real touch of historicity. He keeps on knocking. I mean, that's not necessary for the story. It's just that's what happened. When they finally opened the door and saw him, they were amazed. He motioned for them to quiet down, because I can imagine them jumping up and down. And he told them how the Lord had led him out of prison. Tell James and the other brothers what happened. Now, this James is obviously James, the brother of Jesus, because the other James has just been killed. Tell James and the other brothers what happened, he said. And then he went to another place. Now, this is quite interesting here, if you think about it, because, and if you don't think about it, it's interesting. Because it seems like we have at least three places where the church is meeting, right? We got these people who are at Mary's house, and after Peter arrives, he said, "Tell James and the other brothers," who obviously are at some other place, and then he goes to another place. So it seems like we have at least three places in the city where the churches were meeting. And you know, and that seems to be how the church functioned for quite a long time. In fact, for centuries, they operated as house churches. Clearly, when you get to Colossae, you have house churches there in Colossae, and Laodicea was just across the river. Seems like in Rome there were house churches there, if you study carefully chapter 16 there. So it seems like that what happened is that the churches met in homes. And here we seem to have at least three homes they're meeting with. Mary's home, wherever James and the brothers were, and wherever Peter went to. So it seems like they had these homes. And that seems to be how the early church grew. And obviously that's a little, some of that has to do with not strategic planning. It just has to do with reality. I mean, where else were they going to go? They were going to the temple as a big group, but they were probably persona non grata there once Peter and James was killed and so on. So they really had nowhere else to go. So I'm not sure it was a strategic move as much as this is how it happened. Okay, so then it says, and then Peter went to another place. We don't quite know where Peter went. I mean, he went to another place that night, and then he disappears from the scene. Because, I mean, if Herod had arrested him and was going to put him to death, and then he escapes, you imagine he doesn't want to show up the next morning at the temple. Hey, guys, are up. So he obviously went somewhere. Nobody knows where he went. Obviously, the Roman Catholics like to believe that he went to Rome and started the church in Rome. That makes a nice story. It's really hard to believe that, because in Acts chapter 15, he's back in Jerusalem again, for the council. Some folks, he thinks he went to Antioch, because remember there's an episode in Galatians 2 where Peter has some connection with Antioch. I suspect that he kind of continued his ministry here in this area. You remember he had gone to Lydda and Joppa, and Caesarea and these places here. So I suspect that he preached in this area here, and that's why once the persecution died down, he's able to go back to Jerusalem for the council meeting in Acts chapter 15, which is probably 2 or 3 years after this. So he goes off and we assume he went off for some itinerant kind of a ministry there. All right, then verse 20. Now hold on, where am I? Okay, at 18. At dawn, there was a great commotion among the soldiers about what had happened to Peter. Imagine. The commotion was, you know what normally happened to guards when people escaped? Not good. Herod Agrippa ordered a thorough search for him. So that's why we pretty certainly didn't stay in Jerusalem. And that does give more credence to him going farther away. But, you know, I mean, Osama bin Laden is hidden from us for goodness knows how long on the Pakistani border. I imagine in those days, without drones and things, you could hide pretty well within 50-mile radius of the area. But Herod Agrippa ordered a thorough search for him. When he couldn't be found, Herod interrogated the guards and sentenced them to death. You know, that's always bothered me because the poor guards didn't do anything, but that's what happened. Afterwards, Herod left Judea to stay in Caesarea for a while. So Herod now, because remember, this is Caesarea here. And Caesarea here's Caesarea here, on the coast here. Or maybe just, yeah, over here. He goes to Caesarea, and Tyre and Sidon are over here. Tyre and Sidon are actually in Phoenicia, which is here. I forget which one is which, Tyre and Sidon, and Caesarea is over here. Now, Herod Agrippa controlled most of this area here like this. Actually, it was across there too, particularly Galilee. Food came from Galilee over there, and the folks in Phoenicia had depended upon food from Galilee. That's the issue that's going to happen there. And it appears that Herod had got ticked off with them and it stopped the flow of food. He might have also placed an embargo on their ports and made Caesarea the only port people can come through. But there's something like that going on over here. Verse 20. So Herod's in Caesarea over here. Now Herod was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon up in Phoenicia here. They weren't technically under his control. They were part of Phoenicia. And he was a ruler over Judea and Galilee there. So they sent a delegation to make peace with him because their cities were dependent upon Herod's country for food. So Phoenicia was dependent upon Galilee there for food. The delegates won the support of Blastus, Herod's personal assistant. And appointment with Herod was granted. So these people got on their hands, you know, hat in hand to Herod to say, look, don't cut us off. You know, we'll pay whatever tribute you want, but we got to have the food that comes from Galilee. That's extremely important. Appointment with Herod was granted. When the day arrived, Herod put on his royal robes, sat on his throne, and made a speech to them. The people gave him a great ovation, shouting, "It's the voice of a god and not a man." Now, this is an interesting episode because this episode is recorded in Josephus, as well as a couple of other historians. But this account is recorded in Josephus. It happens in 44 AD. So this is part of why we can figure out when things took place and how they're dated. And Josephus records this thing going there. Josephus says that he died of stomach internal stomach problems, and Josephus says that implies that God did it because he didn't tell the people to stop calling him a god. Because remember, Josephus was basically Jewish, so Josephus saw it clearly as God doing it, and his account is very similar to Luke's. And so they sort of cover the same territory. Luke obviously gives here through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So here are these people saying it's a god, he's a god and not a man. And, you know, generally those leaders at those days were not short of ego and pride. They probably secretly thought they were a god. Heck, I know some real estate developers that think that in Newport Beach. Nobody I know, but actually none of them think that now. I'm referring back to about 5 years ago. All of us sometimes, ego's an incredible deal. You know, we all think we're much more significant than we really are. I mean, ego is just... Okay, verse 23. Instantly, an angel of the Lord, another angel, struck Herod with sickness because he accepted the people's worship instead of giving the glory to God. So he was consumed with worms and died. Now, I always thought those were worms from the outside, but it could be worms from the inside. And that would explain why Josephus says he had the stomach ailment. I always thought he fell on the ground. And those, if I first read this in Africa, where we have lots of worms and wiggly looking guys, I thought some of those kind of jumped on him and kind of killed him. But probably it was it's worms from internally, and that would kind of jive with Josephus. So this is a pretty interesting account here that, you know, you're trying to think of what is Luke trying to communicate to us through Acts chapter 12 here? You know, in the beginning, he creates this enigma that in God's sovereignty, James is killed, but Peter's miraculously rescued. And we sort of don't know why. There's no explanation ever given. It's sort of like Job a little bit. No explanation is given. That's just the way God has allowed it to happen. Stephen was martyred. James is martyred. That sometimes happens. But then Peter is miraculously delivered from prison here. Why? What's the point of that? It's obviously to encourage the church that, you know, God is alive and he can do miracles whenever he wants to do it. And I ran across a little story here that this is a commentary on the book of Acts by a guy by the name of F.F. Bruce. F.F. Bruce was actually a brethren guy who was a New Testament professor at the University of Glasgow. And he's written a lot of commentaries that have historical emphasis. But in his commentary, he gives this illustration. He says, a striking modern parallel has been quoted more than once from the experience of Sundar Singh. Do any of you know about Sundar Singh? He was I also was an Indian guy, but he had a lot of ministry in Burma and Tibet area. And when I was a young Christian growing up, I used to read biographies of Sundar Singh. And he was a great prayer warrior, and God seemed to give him some special power, particularly through prayer. By the order of the chief lama of a Tibetan community, Sundar Singh was thrown into a dry well, the cover of which was securely locked. He was left there to die. Like many others before him, whose bones and rotting flesh lay at the bottom of the well. So, you know, most Christians who were thrown into wells didn't come back up again. They were like James or like Stephen. On the third night, when Sundar had been calling to God in prayer, he heard someone unlocking the cover of the well and removing it. Then a voice spoke, telling him to take hold of the rope that was being lowered. He did so and was glad to find a loop at the bottom of the rope in which he could place his foot, for his arm had been injured before he was thrown down. He was drawn up and the cover was replaced and locked. But when he looked around to thank his rescuer, he could find no trace of him. The fresh air revived him, and his injured arm felt whole again. When morning came, he returned to the place where he had been arrested and resumed preaching. News was brought to the chief lama that a man who had been thrown into the execution well had been liberated and was preaching again. Sundar Singh was brought before him and questioned and told the story of his release. The lama declared that someone must have got hold of a key and let him out. But when search was made for the key, it was found attached to the lama's own girdle. His comment on that is, you know, clearly God's responsible. He could do it all by himself, or he could use somebody. You know, sometimes he uses people, sometimes he doesn't. The point of the thing is God surrendered it. The way Peter's account is told here, we're clearly led to believe it's supernatural. I mean, it is clearly supernatural. I mean, it's hard to see this as a God with an inside job that opened it up and then was killed for doing that. It's clearly a supernatural event. And the story here is that the church was undergoing quite a bit of persecution, and Stephen was killed, James was killed, Acts 8, they're all chased out of the city for a while, and yet every now and again, God does a miracle just to remind us he's on the throne. I always analogize this to Matthew chapter 16 and 17, you know, Jesus says to the disciples, you know, who do you say that I am? And they say, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And they expect, of course, immediately then he's going to set up his kingdom and they're going to be part of the kingdom. And then he gives them those four great revelations. Number one, there's no kingdom. Instead, I'm going to build my church. Number two, I'm going to die. Number three, you're going to suffer. And number four, glory is going to come much later. And the disciples are just reeling, man. Reeling. And then you have chapter 17 when they go up to the Mount of Transfiguration. And I think I always see this through the eyes of Peter for some reason. Peter's just bewildered. I mean, you know, he's just said, you're the Son of the living God, you're the Messiah. And then Jesus said, I'm going to die. And Peter says, no, you're not going to die. And Peter says, Satan's talking through you. So Peter at one moment was the voice of God declaring he's the Messiah. Then he's the voice of Satan saying, you're not going to die. And he's pretty bewildered. And I've been bewildered like that in my Christian life, where I seem to be used by God one minute, used by the devil the next minute, and I'm confused. And then God just kind of, I always look upon him as kind of like I used to do with my boys when they'd done something wrong, and then I was sort of reconciling. I'd rub their hair and say, man, everything's okay. Don't worry. And I kind of get that feeling. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus was ruffling Peter, James, and John's hair, saying, I really am the Messiah. Trust me. And then the voice from heaven comes and says, this is my son. Follow him. Listen to him. And I think this is a little bit of the same there. The church in Jerusalem is struggling. Herod's on the rampage. James has been killed. They expect Peter to be killed. What's next? Is the church going to be wiped out? What's happening? And God does a miracle just to remind them, I really am in control. Trust me. Listen to me. It may be confusing. You may not understand what's happening. In fact, you for sure don't know what's happening. But trust me, I am in control. And at any moment, I can do a miracle like this. Don't usually do it, but I can do it anytime I want to. And then I think the end of chapter 12 here, God's judgment upon Herod. I think Luke couldn't resist that. You can't mess with God's people. God's going to get you. And again, we normally don't see them. These folks on TV who mock our faith. I often wish God would give them worms or something like that. But every now and again, he did it to Nebuchadnezzar, you'll remember. And every now and again, he does that. He just comes out of heaven and he just judges somebody. Seldom does it. Book of Acts, he did that to Ananias and Sapphira, who were believers. Here he does it to Herod, just to remind us, I am God. I am in control. I do acknowledge who are following me and who's not. But life down here on earth right now is pretty perplexing. Hang in there. Trust me. I am the Messiah. Listen to me. Trust me. It's perplexing and it's difficult right now. God is doing some great things in your life, and lousy things are happening in your life right now, either with your kids. And one of the biggest challenges those of us older have is our adult children. You know, every time they seem to get ahead of steam in the right direction, then one of the other ones doesn't do good. You spend a whole lot of time praying for your adult children. God, I thought teenagers were hard. Trust me, teenagers are easy. They're at least smaller. Well, mine were never smaller than me. But I had authority over them. Adult children, you have no authority over. All you can do is pray for those folks. So life is perplexing. Deals work. Deals don't happen. You make a bunch of money. You lose a bunch of money. Your aged parents are healthy, and then they suddenly get sick. Always inconvenient times. Life is perplexing. But he is the Messiah. We trust him. He can do a miracle anytime he wants to. Doesn't usually do it, but he can. And that's our faith. Okay, you got about 10, 15 minutes here. And, you know, I'm kind of weird. I'm from Africa, so you got to work with the boy. You know, I decided that, you know, I'm writing out all these questions for you guys like you're sixth graders. And I decided, you guys all got graduate degrees, man. You run businesses. So if you can't figure out what to discuss in Acts chapter 12, go home. Get coffee and go home. Okay, so what do you learn from Acts chapter 12? What can you take with you and talk about it? If you don't know that, just find out, you know, where people work, what they do. If it doesn't work, talk about the Lakers. You got 15 minutes.